afternoon and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and this conversation includes you. As we like to say each week, the phone lines are open, and if you'd like to join us, the number to call from Oahu is 941-3689, and from the neighbor islands, it's 877-941-3689. That number also works if you are in other places than in Hawaii. If you're listening to the live stream and you want to join us, use that 877-941-3689 number. Now, along with death and taxes, for most adults, the third unavoidable in life is change. Most people dislike it, especially the kind of change that has no clear path. But for innovators, the uncut path is exactly what makes them thrive. What with the kind of jobs needed for a future society continually being revealed and reimagined, successful education to prepare students may well be tied to how nimble and responsive education can craft a path now. And under the Every Student Succeeds Act, states have more of an opportunity to do just that. But what exactly should they do? Tony Wagner would suggest teaching to grow creative problem solving, because in the innovation era, he says, it's about what you can do with what you know. Tony Wagner is expert in residence at Harvard's Innovation Lab and senior research fellow at the Learning Policy Institute. He is the co-author of Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Our Kids for the Innovation Era, the basis of the much-lauded documentary of the same name. He's in Hawaii to work with schools and lawmakers to help reimagine what and how our schools teach. Tonight on Town Square, Education for Innovation in the 21st Century. And you can join this discussion at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tony Wagner, welcome to Town Square.
My pleasure, Beth Ann.
Thanks very much for making the time. I know you've had a really busy schedule. So here we are in the 21st century for at least 17 years now, but our school system is rooted in a century ago. How do you characterize the educational system that most Americans know?
Well, as you just mentioned, Beth Ann, the system was created about 125 years ago as we were transitioning from a rural agrarian economy with its one-room schoolhouses to an industrial economy. And we needed many, many more workers to have basic literacy and numeracy skills, as well as sort of character skills of citizenship, of punctuality, and a certain kind of deference to authority, and so on. So we created what I think of now as the factory model of education. Then as we came more into the knowledge economy in the 60s and 70s, what we did with that kind of batch processing assembly line model of education was lengthen the assembly line. Kids went to school for more time. So instead of going to school just through eighth grade, it became high school and then increasingly some college. So all we've really done in some respects is take that assembly line method of instruction and lengthen it by having kids spend more time in it up until the present day, where it's increasingly clear that system is failing some kids, but more importantly, it's obsolete for all kids.
And is that why we're seeing such a high percentage of kids who even have bachelor's degrees unable to find work?
That's right, Beth Ann. The problem with a degree today is that it's not really a certificate of mastery, not a certificate of competencies. It's a certificate of seat time served. I've collected my Carnegie units, so I get my high school diploma. Then I sit in more classes, and I get a college diploma. And that's why so many of our kids today are underemployed as recent college graduates. And what do I mean by underemployed? They are BA baristas or BA bartenders. They're kids who are working jobs that don't pay a BA wage. And so in many cases, they're really unable to pay back an average of $33,000 of debt from their college loans.
For those kids and their families, hearing some of what you've just said, when they've been so programmed and their parents have been so programmed and their parents have probably been so programmed to know that or believe that college is the track to success, and that we hear this figure bandied about that if you go to college, you're on average going to make about $1 million more over your lifetime than someone who doesn't. Those things have been so well entrenched. And hearing all of what you've just said, I can imagine is making some parents think, you know, why are we doing this? But it's very hard to get off that track. How do you help them move into a different idea of thinking that is so rooted in what you say is the innovation era?
Well, first of all, I'm not saying kids should not go to college. And in the past, it's certainly been the case that kids who've gone to college and gotten a degree have had a real advantage. But you know, Beth Ann, about one out of every two kids who starts down the college path never completes a degree at all. And they're the ones who are accumulating enormous debt and increasingly unable to pay it. So what I'm really saying is that we need to pause. And instead of sort of the mantra of all kids college ready, all kids should have the choice of college, of course. No adult should make that decision for any child. But to me, the mantra really is all kids innovation ready. And the questions we should be talking with young people about don't start with college, it seems to me. We should start instead by saying, how do you imagine yourself in the world? What kind of work do you want to do? What do you want to create? What problem do you want to solve? Who do you want to serve or work with? So we start that conversation by requiring all students to, first of all, job shadow. Shadow people in jobs. Second of all, have many more career days in schools where outsiders come in and talk about their work. And thirdly, we should require both work-based and service learning internships, where young people go out into the community and learn and explore new possibilities. Then I think beginning in 10th or 11th grade, we can pose the question, how do you imagine yourself in the world now that you've explored these things? And then map backwards from their answer to, well, let's look at what post-secondary could mean for you. Because all kids are going to need post-secondary, Beth, and that's not the question here. That's not an issue. But should it be, you know, training for a trade? Should it be community college? Should it be a host of other possibilities? Should students take a gap year or two or three before going to college? To me, those are the more relevant and important questions that will enable young people to think far more intentionally about how they want to be in the adult world and what will best prepare them.
What I hear you say, or at least the subtext of what you're saying, is that we really have to redefine success for young people and let that come into their lives based on who they really are in this sort of process of reverse engineering where they're going or their trajectory into post-secondary based on who they are. That's not really the message that they get in pop culture, and it's certainly not the message that they get in a lot of schools that have been, you know, caught up in the model that has been around for 120 years.
Well, that's right. I think the problem is that we've defined success as a set of sort of financial achievements, if you will, a kind of status. But realistically, Beth Ann, many of our kids may not reach the same level of affluence that they're accustomed to. And what more and more young people are telling me is they don't necessarily want to own a house and maybe not even a car. What they want is satisfying, meaningful work. They want to make a contribution. They want to make a difference. And to me, those are things that we should be encouraging and applauding our young people who maybe want less materially, but want more in terms of a rich, satisfying, and balanced life.
Unlike perhaps the lives that they see that their parents and grandparents are living.
Well, you know, those families were and generations were products of their era. You know, we can't judge them. They were coming out of the Depression, our grandparents. Our parents are coming out of World War II, which was kind of a lean time. So for them to want to strive for a certain kind of material well-being and security above everything else is completely understandable. But we shouldn't necessarily assume that's the number one concern of our young people today, because I'm finding that it's not. Whether they're from privilege or whether they're from poverty, they're asking different questions. They're seeking different solutions.
What are the questions that they're asking themselves that they're telling you?
Well, over and again, I hear young people saying, how can I make a difference? How can I make a contribution? I want to do work worth doing. You know, they start asking that even in school. It's really quite shocking. You know,
young
people will say, you know, I'm talking about middle and high school kids are saying, in effect, you know, this homework is not, doesn't, A, seems like make work. I don't understand why I'm being asked to do this. I'll never do this again in my adult life. Why am I doing this now? And B, you know, I want to put effort into work worth doing, whether it's in school or out in the community. And to me, that's what's really a shift in this generation. And whether they're responding unconsciously and intuitively to more limited possibilities, or whether it's really a kind of a flowering of a new era and generation of idealism, I can't say. But it's quite apparent, and it's across cultures, too. I don't just see it here in the U.S. I've heard it around the world in my travels.
And we're going to talk a little bit later, too. But for the moment, I want to remind our audience that you are listening to Town Square tonight. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, where is education going for the 21st century? How can you prepare your kids for the innovation era and beyond? Things we don't know that may be coming down the pike. We do know change is inevitable, and how well we prepare our kids to be facile and responsive to what's happening and to be able to have meaningful lives. That's part of what we're talking about tonight with Tony Wagner, expert in residence at Harvard's Innovation Lab. You may know him from his book, Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Our Kids for the Innovation Era, and also the film of the same name, the documentary. Our number here is 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. If you're a teacher or if you're a parent, do you feel that you're being able to produce the kind of work for your child, either at home or at school, that allows your child to develop some of these characteristics that might tend to form a path for that child later in life? Or are you really telling children that, no, you got to do it this way? How are you viewing this idea of innovation training and creative problem solving, all of that that seems to be very different than the way most of us were trained in school? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Okay, so if that's where we are now, what's the bridge to where some have already gotten, despite perhaps some of the way they've been taught?
Well, I think the first step is for leaders, community leaders, civic leaders, business leaders, education leaders, to work together to answer a very fundamental question. And the question is, what does it mean to be an educated adult in the 21st century? What should a high school graduate know and be able to do? I mean, we're just taking a curriculum that we've had for more than 50 years and assuming that's the answer to the question. Whereas I think what we need to start with is re-examining the basic goals of education in the 21st century.
So
and
what are
when
they?
We do, I think, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, so what are they? Because as you know, you see them very differently than a lot of people see them. How do you think we need to look at it a little differently as we begin to ask some of those questions, or at least allow the space to ask some questions?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we understand is that our education system was designed and created in an era of knowledge scarcity. The only way you could acquire knowledge up until very recently was to have a teacher. Teacher knew it all, and therefore you had to sit at the feet of the teacher, literally or figuratively, to acquire knowledge. Well, that's no longer true. Google knows everything. And because Google knows everything, and because you can acquire knowledge instantly and independently of a teacher, there's no longer a competitive advantage in knowing the person more than the person next to you, because they can Google it just in time and figure it out. So what we assumed as the goal of education, merely acquiring content knowledge, seems to me to be obsolete in the era of the Internet and the capacity to learn independently. So what I like to say is that academic content knowledge still matters. It matters that we know where we're from. It matters that we know our cultural history, our background, and the achievements of humanity. But in the innovation era, skills matter more than content knowledge. And motivation matters most. Because if you are self-motivated, you will continuously acquire both new content knowledge and new skills throughout your life, which I think is an absolute prerequisite for thriving and well-being in the 21st century. And to be very clear, when I talk about skills, I'm not just talking about workplace skills. What is extraordinary about this moment in history is that the skills you need for work, the skills you need for active and informed citizenship, and the skills you need for lifelong learning have converged. They are the same skills.
Some of the interpersonal skills the ability to relate to other human beings, especially given all the technology that we all use and all the devices that we all carry, the ability to speak well, to be able to feel comfortable speaking. That's all something I think that you would put into the skills needed to get on in the 21st century, would they not?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the core contradictions between preparing young people for the world we live in today versus the world of school is that in the world of school, you spend your entire time working alone, except for basically a few projects that are not very well organized or thought through, but you work alone and you compete against others. Where in the world of innovation, you know, there is no such thing as working alone all day, every day. Innovation is a team sport, and you have to understand how to work effectively in a team to thrive in today's world, whether it's teamwork for citizenship or teamwork in the workplace.
All right, we're going to take a caller. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. You have a chance to talk with Tony Wagner about innovation in the 21st century in educational systems. Where are we going in Hawaii? Where are we going as a nation? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Paul, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Paul. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi.
Hi there.
I agree with your guess, and I just wanted to say that I'm a college graduate, and went through, you know, the system of my parents wanting us to get a good job and stuff. I graduated from engineering school and was still kind of baffled about what an engineer does, but, you know, was able to go on with a career. And now I have a kid who, you know, doesn't sit in the classroom. He's a little boy, and he doesn't want to be there. They're constantly correcting him for behaving like a little boy. And what's the alternative for me as a parent? I know he doesn't belong there, but there's no alternatives. In, you know, like, so if we're going to talk about how are we going to prepare our kids, what are our choices? Because there's no institutional choices out there besides middle school and high school. And
all right, Paul, let me see if I can get some input here from Tony. Tony, were you able to hear him?
Yes, I heard Paul clearly.
Okay,
Paul, this
good.
This is a dilemma I hear from parents so often. And that's why when we were just talking a moment ago, what's the bridge? We were talking first about clarifying new goals for education. Then it's investing in laboratories of educational innovation. And I'm talking about charter schools and other kinds of public schools consciously exploring new models that give kids, teachers, and parents all a real choice. And I've met some amazing leaders of schools here in Hawaii. I've spent time at the Mid-Pacific Institute, a private school, and seeing extraordinary innovation. I've spent time talking to the leaders of SEEKS, the school for examining essential questions of sustainability, and was enormously impressed by their curriculum. They're a middle school, and they want to become a high school. I spent time, I can't recall the name, I'm sorry, but it was a charter school focused on voyaging as a concept and was founded by Nainoa Thompson of the Hokulea fame, and an elementary school that I think is doing extraordinary work. We need many more schools like that, schools of choice that give people like Paul's son options that they don't now have.
You talk about middle schools and high schools, but I think for Paul, looking at elementary schools, I know you mentioned one, but in general, when, you know, kids come out of preschool where there may be some structure, there is some learning, but it's, you know, learning through play, which is how we were told kids learn a lot at that point. And that you have a child whose mind is the most open it's ever going to be. And then they come into a kindergarten situation or even a first grade situation, and they're told in many cases to sit down, be quiet, and follow the teacher still. That disconnect is where a lot of issues happen for children like Paul's son, it seems. Where can we start to be able to bring this in earlier to understand that a child's mind and that idea of innovation and being able to have that creative problem-solving space needs to happen really early in a child's life? How do we begin to change it there?
You're exactly right. We are born curious, creative, imaginative. That's the human DNA. The average five-year-old asks 100 questions a day, and most kindergartners think of themselves as artists. But then something happens. We call it school, because the longer kids are in school, the less curious they become. The more they become preoccupied with getting the right answers than asking the right questions. But let's be clear, this is not the fault of teachers. Most elementary teachers know the value of play. They've read about Finland, where kids spend 15 minutes of every hour out in recess and playing. They understand that. Here's the problem. We have focused our schooling too narrowly on preparation for tests. Now, I believe in accountability. I'm all for it. And there's an argument to be made that Hawaii has made some progress in closing the achievement gap by this focus. But right now, that focus is far too limiting. There's too much testing, too much pressure on teachers, too much pressure on kids. And most importantly, we're not testing the right things. We're using simple multiple choice tests that tell us absolutely nothing about the skills you need for work, learning, and citizenship in the 21st century. We've got to modernize assessment. We've got to do sample testing, not testing every kid every year. Sample testing demographic samples of kids every 3 years. Take the pressure off teachers. Take the pressures off kids so they can do what they know is right.
And what about portfolios as opposed to a test?
Well, of course, once we decide on new goals for education, every student needs to learn how to think critically, which means asking good questions, weighing evidence, understanding perspectives and points of view. That's all a part of critical thinking. Communicating effectively, orally and in writing, learning to listen well, being an effective collaborator, and being a creative problem solver, along with the dispositions of learning through trial and error, taking initiative. These are the things that matter most in the adult world. We know that. So what we would do is design a portfolio system where students would have to present and defend work that shows evidence of mastery of these core competencies, habits of mind and heart. And we'd backwards map that. And we'd say that students would be presenting these evidence of mastery at the end of eighth grade, the end of fifth grade. What I'm really advocating is that a high school diploma be a collection of merit badges, if you will. I'm borrowing from scouting. Not sort of a grade on a test. In fact, the only grades I can really justify are A, B, or incomplete. How many people want to fly with a C-minus airline pilot? The bell curve makes no sense in the adult world. So we have to really fundamentally, once we've redefined the goals of education, rethink assessment, rethink grading and accountability.
We're going to take some more callers. If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about changes in a school system that's rooted in 120 years ago and where it is our kids are going to be able to cope with a future. We don't exactly know, but there are skills they're going to need. Tony Wagner has just outlined a whole bunch of them. We're going to talk more about that this hour on Town Square, and you're invited to participate. Our number is 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu and from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689. Going to Kyra calling us from Wilhelmina Rise. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I am just wondering if any studies have been done around this young demographic before entering kindergarten and early kindergarten, where they are creative problem solvers, collaborators, like everything that a 21st century learner needs to be, they're pretty much infused with coming into the school system. Have there been studies around how do you continue that rather than feeding them more information that may actually stump that type of already inherent learning?
Well, that's a great question. And the good news is we have had not just research, but outstanding examples of great elementary schools going back to the days of Maria Montessori. Maria Montessori clearly described how young people play, how their social skills as well as their intellectual skills are developed through play. And then Reggio Emilia, an education reform movement out of Italy, has built on the work of Maria Montessori and continues to this day. Some of the very best elementary education I have ever seen has been at the Mid-Pacific Institute, which is focused entirely on the Reggio Emilia approach. So the answer is yes, more than just research. We have great schools we can point to, both public schools, there are a number of public schools who are Montessori-based, as well as independent schools. So So we do know that there are better ways to do this. So it requires a kind of will, a kind of intentionality, and a clarity about goals and assessment and accountability that we currently lack.
And where would you peg Hawaii in that journey?
You know, I think it's very interesting what's happening here. I had the opportunity to speak at a conference a week ago Saturday of leading educators on Oahu from the public education system. The chair of the Board of Education was there. The governor was there and spoke. And I think there's tremendous receptivity to many of these ideas that I see here. And in fact, as some of you may know, the film we've made called Most Likely to Succeed will have its very first statewide airing on Hawaii Public Television. And I think it's February 14th or 16th. You'll have to check your listings, but it's the first primetime listing of this film that has gone statewide. It's been been shown in communities all over the state. So, and I think the time is very ripe for a different conversation here in Hawaii. You know, Hawaii was one of the first states to come up with a different description of education goals and outcomes. It was called the General Learner Outcomes. I was here 7, 8, 9 years ago when we were working on this.
I remember.
And it's a very good and clear set of goals. So this initial work has been done. What has not yet been done is building the infrastructure, funding educational innovations, research and development. I know the governor actually wants to start a fund to create many more of the kinds of schools I'm describing. And then creating an assessment and accountability system, getting out from underneath the umbrella of the current accountability system. And the good news is the new law called ESSA, Every Student Succeed Act, allows states much more latitude than they've had for the last 15 years to create better assessments and different assessments than what the federal government has been pushing for so long.
We're going to take a few more callers, Tony, because I know there are a lot of people who want to talk with you. Jada calling us from Kamuela. Aloha, Jada. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question. I just want to know, what are the speaker's thoughts about Donald Trump's nominee, Betsy DeVos? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Well, we knew sooner or later someone was going to ask you that question.
Well, I have to go now. I hear my airplane calling me.
How concerned are you about her background and the fact that she has a very distinct perception of what should happen with education, at least in terms of choice and vouchers?
Well, her theory of change is that schools are broken because they're monopolies. Public schools are kind of monopolies. And therefore, the solution is choice and vouchers. For those of you who don't know, the idea of a voucher is that you give every family some money to choose the school of their choice, and the money travels with you. There are many, many problems with this, the first of which starts right in her home state, where she's advocated this for a very long time. The result is there are a lot of for-profit charter schools in that state, Wisconsin, that are absolutely horrible, because there's no oversight. So the idea that we're going to just proliferate choices for kids without any kind of meaningful oversight or screening process. And now I'm favor charters. I mean, Massachusetts, for example, has charter schools, but you don't just get handed one because you say, yeah, I'm for choice. Give me some of your voucher money and, you know, come to my school. No, you have to produce real education outcomes. There's an auditing system where you look at student work, you look at teacher work, you have people come and visit your school, and if you don't meet a standard, you're closed down, or you never get the charter to begin with. So the idea that we're going to just kind of willy-nilly give everybody some money to go off and have a school, I think, is terrifying.
All right. Well, on that happy note, we're going to move along and take another caller. Going to go now to Chris calling us from Kapolei. Aloha, Chris. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'm curious, what can I do? My kid's much like I am, where it doesn't sit, no, I don't want to say doesn't sit well, but like, what can I do to foster his curiosity, like within a classroom of 30 other kids? I mean, what can I do working with a teacher where, like, yep. Again, standardized tests, where can I move forward?
I think we're back to that question, Tony, of for a lot of parents, as we had earlier when Paul called, what do I do right now?
That's a really key question. I would pursue two tracks, and I say this both as a parent and now a grandparent. First of all, you know, the most elementary thing parents can do is take kids' curiosity seriously, no matter where it leads or where it goes, but to really trust the fact that, you know, kids want to explore interests and need that leeway. You know, even if they seem sort of bent on doing something that seems silly or foolish, give them the chance to try something new, try out a new idea, try out a new interest, to be always kind of saying, well, what would you like to try, or what are your questions? You know, one idea that I've had recently for both parents and teachers is to encourage kids to keep a question journal. Just write down the questions they're interested in that occur to them through the day or the week, or the problems they're concerned about. And then every once in a while, sit down with a child, whether you're a parent or a teacher, and ask them to circle the question or the concern, the problem that most interests them. And try to create time and space for a child to sort of explore that. You know, I think so often our kids' lives are overprogrammed and we send them to stuff. And a lot of that has benefit and value. But what I've discovered is that getting kids outside, getting them more in touch with nature, you know, one very dynamic parent of a very successful young innovator said to me, you know, sometimes kids have to get bored in order to learn how to get unbored. And that's where the innovation begins to happen, where they start using their imagination, using their creativity, using their curiosity to generate a life of learning and inquiry for themselves. So that's what we build on as parents and teachers.
And very quickly, because we are certainly still continuing in the age of helicopter parenting, how do you get a parent to just back off of that and not try to overly schedule a child thinking that it's enrichment, where it may frankly be babysitting or a way of not being able to engage in the way that you're suggesting?
Well, first of all, we need to have real sympathy for parents today. Parents today are frightened. They see a far more competitive world than the one that they grew up in. And they want to give their children an advantage, a competitive advantage. And I completely understand that. But where things go awry is they think the competitive advantage comes from doing more things, maybe getting into name brand schools or name brand colleges, and that therefore the competitive advantage is kids achieving more and having higher status schools. But guess what? That doesn't work anymore, Bethan. The competitive advantage that I see that young people have acquired are young people who know who they are, who know what their interests are, who can take initiative, who have tenacity and perseverance that they've learned through trial and error, they've learned through adult coaching. You know, get up, try it again. Not poor dear, you know, you fell down. Get up, try it again. Young people who've had real work-based internships or service learning opportunities in the summers and had some sense of who they are in this world and what they want to do in that world. Those are the young people who have the real competitive advantage because they know who they are and they're grounded and they've experienced setbacks and they know how to deal with those.
It's interesting. I hear you hearkening back to some of the characteristics that our great-grandparents would have nodded and thought was a really good thing. The sense of tenacity, get up, do it again, figure it out for yourself. I'm not going to give you all the answers. You're going to have to find your own place. That kind of thinking that went away in the latter part of last century. And I also hear you're saying, Tiger Moms, back off. We're going to take a few more calls. Going off to Stephen, calling us from Maui. Aloha, Stephen. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Thank you. I taught school for a while, and then I went to law school. And while I was teaching school, I became so frustrated. And what I discovered was the John Holt series of How Children Learn, How Children Fail. And when I started reading that, this is after I graduated from college and was a teacher, it was completely shocking but eye-opening. Then I got into other books such as Teaching as a Subversive Activity, Postgarden, Weinberg and Postgarden. And it just opened my mind up to a lot of different ways to look at this because they kept saying, hey, even at the turn of the century, Dewey was saying at the turn of the century, the system was screwed up. Anything you did, didn't matter what, would improve the system. It was just that bad. And that's how I started to feel. While I was in law school, I finally understood how schools probably would be better off. Because in law school, they don't teach you facts. They don't teach you how to do this, how to do that. All they teach you is how to find the answer to a problem. And that is how I think of teaching. So one of the things I did during the time I was still teaching is instead of just going, because I was teaching social studies, instead of just saying, here's your subject matter, here's your project, I would say, build a boat and shut up. And you would get the most confused looks on kids' faces. But I started to see them divide into three groups. The first group was, oh, my God, Steve, what do we do? I don't get it. I don't know how to do that. The second group was, I don't know. And the third group was just go off and do it, and they kind of created stuff. And you really began to see and force them to think for themselves to find solutions to problems. Because just by saying building a boat, they would say, well, what kind of boat? It was a, you choose. Well, how do you choose? Well, you got to do some research. And then you say, well, how do we build a boat? You know, well, then you got to learn how to do that. I mean, you go through the whole process. You learn math. You learn history. You learn physics. You learn navigation. There's so many different things they learn just by that one phrase, go build a boat. And what I'm hearing you say, I mean, I'm not hearing you saying go build a boat, but I hear you kind of saying that same sort of thing. It's just let them figure it out. Learn by experience and by discovery rather than here it is, here it is, here it is, here it is.
Stephen, thank you very much for your call, and good luck and lucky students that you must have. Tony, as you hear what Stephen has been describing, the idea that, you know, we perhaps might need more integrated curriculums and not segmenting things. Oh, this is math. Oh, this is social studies. You know, this is language arts. But understanding that life is not segmented in that way. Why should school be? And why should that stifle somebody's creativity when there is real, when there's a real problem that needs to be solved and you have to draw on all those areas?
Well, that's right. Bethan, there are three fundamental contradictions between the traditional culture of schooling and the culture of innovation that I think every young person must be prepared for. And by innovation, I do mean creative problem solving, whether it's building a better boat or solving the problem of energy sufficiency on the island or whatever the problem is. Three contradictions. One is, you know, schools focus on individual achievement. Innovation is a team sport. Number two, schools compartmentalize knowledge in favor of kind of specialization, where increasingly no problem can be understood, let alone solved, using just one academic discipline. Whether it's building a boat or energy sustainability, you have to use an interdisciplinary approach. And the third is the importance of trial and error. You know, we penalize errors in school, and yet, in fact, how we learn often, most often, is through trial and error. Have we learned to talk or walk or ride a bike? All those things are learned through trial and error. And when we penalize errors in school and take points off, we're creating risk aversion. We're creating passive kids afraid to take initiative, afraid to try something new. So I actually think those things are things that we absolutely must change about how we school kids. So I agree with Stephen. The only slight kind of addition I would add, that literature, I grew up on that literature. I, too, was a high school English teacher, and I had read all of that literature. But what I see today is not just leaving kids alone. I think good teachers are more than just facilitators. They are performance coaches. They're coaching students to a higher performance standard, just like a coach does on the athletic field or in the performance hall of the arts. So that's, to me, the new model for teaching in the 21st century.
And very quickly, would you apply that to the teachers themselves in terms of team teaching and being able to coach each other and having a much more collaborative relationship than one that might be more segmented in terms of, oh, it's not, this isn't my department, or I'm really not involved with that, but being able to bring teachers together so that they can also become a little bit less risk-averse and model that for kids?
Absolutely. Isolation is the enemy of improvement. Isolation is the enemy of innovation. One reason I think we've had so little innovation in education over the last century is because teachers are profoundly isolated. You know, one of my favorite schools, a public school called High Tech High, the single most important innovation was team teaching. By the way, that's the school that's featured in our film, Most Likely to Succeed, that Hawaiians can see next month. So you're absolutely right, Bethann. We need, all of us need help and coaching. All, peer review is the most powerful form of accountability, far more important in terms of actually helping us improve than top-down accountability that so characterizes many schools today.
All right, we're going to take some more callers. If you'd like to join us, our number is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, please use that number, 941-3689, or from the neighbor islands or anywhere else, 877-941-3689. Going to Cami calling us from Manoa. Aloha, Cami, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. I was just going to make a comment and a question to the speaker. It sounds like he visited Malama Honua Charter School in Waimanalo, the one based on voyaging. But has he ever visited any of our Hawaiian-focused charter schools like Halau Kumana or place-based learning Hawaiian-focused Hakipu'u Learning Center?
Tony, any other of the schools that are...
Yes, that was the school that I visited. And I did a lot of work with the West Hawaii complex, area complex, years ago. And they have, as you know, a middle school that is Hawaiian-focused. And we spent a great deal of time there. Sean is the principal there. And I learned an enormous amount in talking to folks there. I also met with leaders from Kamehameha schools in the last 10 days. And they, too, are deeply interested in these ideas.
Right. Well, the problem that we're having, like Halau Kumana, the Hawaiian-focused charter school in Makiki, is doing extremely well, creating as what you're kind of describing as great citizens of the world, you know, great citizens of Hawaii, and their focus is that the students grow up and contribute back to our lahui. However, it's disappointing and disgruntling that every year the legislator, our problem is the legislator, not giving them the full amount of funding that the other DOE students get. Per student, they're not getting 100% of what DOE students are contributing, and so that's our problem. They're doing an awesome job. I'd love to see more schools like that. However, every year, the legislature, they just don't give the money to continue these programs.
And that's been an ongoing problem that charters have had since they started, that they are forced to pay for things like facilities and they may or may not have the facilities available. And they have some other assorted issues, too, that mean that, in fact, kids get less than a child would be getting if you're going to divide it up equally, and that it becomes problematic for charters to stay in business.
And the teachers are working with less, but yet creating amazing results.
Tony, go ahead.
No, that's exactly right. Your speaker points to a profound challenge, but it's not just in Hawaii. I see it in most states where charter schools actually get less than public schools, less per kid, and it's also, as you've just pointed out, Bethann, they're not getting what we would call infrastructure money, money for buildings. That's the problem that so many charter schools have. They can't find the space because they can't afford it. And so they have to spend additional time fundraising and in order to raise the money needed to buy a new space.
Thanks, Cami, for the call. We're going to go now to Anne calling us from Ainahaina. Aloha, Anne. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I wanted to ask him your speaker, if he had checked out Waldorf schools. My daughter graduated from one here on Oahu, and when we went and applied to colleges, the college admissions people were all saying, oh, we love Waldorf students because they know how to think out of the box.
And you must have been looking over my shoulder because I had written Waldorf with a question mark to ask that
Tony,
too.
To the test, they're experiential, they're based on the question. You answer the question, find the answer, learn how to problem solve, be creative, make a portfolio. It's everything he tells is the greatest schools, and it's completely absent from what he talks about. So what's going on?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think the Waldorf model is a fascinating model, and I should have included it in my list. The reason I frequently don't is because I've never been in a public Waldorf school, whereas I've been in many public Montessori schools and some public schools are based on Reggio Emilia. So pardon my oversight, but you're absolutely right. All of those schools, which have been going for very long periods of time, those models of education, do point to dramatically better ways to engage our young people.
Going now to Sue calling us from Pune. Aloha, Sue. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you for taking my call. Several things. First of all, if you want to see a public Waldorf school, come to the Big Island. We have a number of them, especially here in the Pune area, Hawaii Academy of Arts and Sciences. And the charters here are under the umbrella of the DOE. So there is accountability and there is a continuity. My daughter is a teacher of 23 years in the Waldorf method. And she starts a class of first graders and takes them through to sixth grade in the current system, and then they transfer to a middle school campus, so they're familiar with going from class to class and teacher to teacher. And her ability to know a kid through their ups and downs, strengths and weaknesses in 6 years is just remarkable.
I'm going to just stop you there for a second because you brought up a point that I want to ask Tony. What Sue is bringing up and what we see in the Waldorf schools is the idea of just, you know, kids staying with their teacher, looping, going from, you know, year to year for a certain period of time. How crucial is that in the idea of both team teaching and also teaching for innovation?
I think, first of all, I now want to go visit those Waldorf schools on the Big Island. I'm very excited to hear.
Well, you're there,
that,
and you can.
So thank you for that. But to the deeper point about looping, here's why it's so important to think about teachers knowing their kids well and spending more time with them. And it goes back to very new brain research. What we know about the brain, the part of the brain that is responsible for perseverance, tenacity, self-discipline, self-regulation, capacity to focus, all of that prefrontal cortex. Now, the prefrontal cortex is destroyed by stress. I mean, the synapses are absolutely destroyed, not just retarded, destroyed. Number one stressor, childhood poverty. But there are other forms of stress. So that's the bad news. The good news is nurturance, positive adult nurturance, rebuilds the prefrontal cortex. That's why I think, in general, many of these newer small high schools, academies within large high schools, have much, much better results because they're actually providing nurturance. Every kid feels known. Finland, the highest performing education system in the world, every young teacher spends 3 or 4 or 5 years with the same group of kids through both elementary and middle. So, and there's no stress in Finland schools. They start school 1 year later. They have a shorter school day, a shorter school year. They do almost no homework, and they have no poverty. And they're the highest performing education system in the world. And yes, you know, it's a small country and somewhat homogenous, but in many respects, it's the size of Hawaii. And there is much that we could learn there. And certainly the idea of looping and nurturance and spending a longer period of time with kids is one of them that's very important.
For a while there, not all that many years ago, there were teachers who told me that they were a little afraid of being too nurturant, that they didn't want to have any, you know, transference, that they weren't there to be the surrogate parent, but they were there to be the teacher. And some were even afraid of, you know, picking up a child or hugging a child. How has that happened in recent years? Has that gone away?
I think there's still a tremendous amount of anxiety and uncertainty among teachers in this regard. You know, we've become such a litigious society, and I think many teachers fear even touching children on the shoulder or on the arm, and I think that's really unfortunate. But so the idea, again, is nurturance and coaching combined. It's not one versus the other. It's not just, you know, telling kids that they're wonderful no matter what they do. It's coaching them to continue to learn from mistakes, to learn and to continue to grow with that emotional support that we all need.
We're going to take a few more callers if you want to join us. There is still time. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. My guest tonight is Tony Wagner. You may know him from his book, Most Likely to Succeed. Also, the film of the same name, which will be shown in Hawaii on PBS next month. Going now to Tommy calling us from Hawaii Kai. Aloha, Tommy. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you for taking my call. When I was in graduate school, well, the school that most interested me was Neil Summerhill. Did you ever read his book? And did any of his theories ever get across your table?
Yes, absolutely. When I read it, when I was 19 years old, and it liberated me because I didn't like school very much through my first elementary, middle, and high school. And I thought maybe, well, there's something wrong with me. But then I read Summerhill, and I thought, no, maybe there's not anything wrong with me. Maybe there's something wrong with school. And that's why I decided to become a teacher. But again, you know, that book, along with the others that the earlier caller mentioned, I think play too much to the idea that teachers should just sit back and give kids unlimited choice. I've come to believe, both as a parent and as a teacher of many years' experience, that model is too passive. That you don't just give kids complete and total unlimited freedom. Kids need guardrails. They need coaching, they need nurturance, and they need guardrails.
Which is more than
you sit on them. Go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry, I just want to ask, which is more than sort of this idea of being the guide on the side that we heard for a while, which seems to be moving more in that more passive territory than someone is helping to ask questions and engender a lot more curiosity about whatever it is you may have to do or being able to solve a problem.
That's right. It's a much more active role for teachers. By the way, before we just get too far at the end of the day, I want to make very clear, I am the co-author of Most Likely to Succeed. The other author is Ted Dintersmith, and he's going to be spending a lot of time in Hawaii in February.
And we're going to be talking to him, too.
Showing. And, I understand you're going to have him on the show. I just want to sort of give credit where credit's due.
Credit where credit is due. And I'm sorry, because earlier we talked about you as the co-author, and when we just talk about it as your book, yeah. We didn't mention Ted. But, yes, we'll be talking to him, too, because he had a very different role in this. And that's a whole other conversation that we're going to have with him when he's in Hawaii. We're going to go now to Daniel calling us from Kapahulu. Aloha, Daniel. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thanks a lot. I just want to mention my son. He got a GE, and he would feel like he's gotten so far a really good education here. You mentioned charter schools, private schools. I just was wondering about, you know, that's kind of like skimming the cream off a lot of schools or a lot of public schools. And I was just wondering, say, you have these certain schools that are maybe near public housing and they have a lot of dysfunction and difficulties, and you kind of touched on it, but maybe if you have, you know, could go on to some of the ideas you have about dealing with those schools, because it seems they have really kind of, it's a little different, and their issues are not necessarily, you know, the sky is the limit and dream and imagination, but I don't know, maybe there's a different approach, because some of those kids are really, those schools are tough, and it's tough for the teachers, too. Thank you very much.
Daniel, thank you very much for that reminder. And truthfully, because we know, Tony, you never know where brilliance is going to come from. Every kid should have a shot to be able to strive for his or her potential. What happens when you have a kid who's in a school like some of the schools that Daniel just described?
Well, first of all, Daniel's right. I mean, the real challenge we face today is that there are lots of parents who don't feel they have a choice, certainly don't have a choice of private school. And vouchers aren't going to be enough to make that any different. They don't know about charter schools, or the charter schools they do know about are too full or too far away. So I'd like to see every parent and child feel as though they have a real choice of schools, every parent, not just the ones who are more affluent or who kind of go out and look for something different. I think we need, and this is happening in cities like Cambridge, Massachusetts, where every school is a school of choice, every single school. And the schools differentiate themselves. And parents get literature at a very, very early age, helping them to better understand their choices. So I think it works as well for high poverty schools as well as for any other kind of school. And I, by the way, have seen kids come out of extreme poverty and be extraordinary innovators and creative problem solvers. In fact, there's an academic, Robert Sternberg, who actually believes there are three kinds of intelligence: creative, practical, and analytic. The analytic is the only kind that's favored in school, and it's the creative and practical that ultimately are more important. And his view is kids coming out of poverty have more of that kind of intelligence, but we don't recognize it or test for it.
So in a school situation like Daniel brought up, where you can't go in there and remake the whole system, what's a parent to do? I think that was part of his question, too. How do parents perhaps have a different relationship with their children in that way? And
yep.
They, too, may also be very challenged working many jobs, or they may be literacy challenged. There may be other issues in their lives that cause them not to be able to have that time with their children. So what other burdens may be put then on the teacher to fill some of that role?
Well, the burdens are the same, I think. You know, there are a lot of parents who have careers and jobs. So let me quickly tell the story of Jamien Sills. Grows up, he's the only child in a single-parent family. Mother's working incredibly hard, inner city, extremely challenged. Jamien sees Wilt Chamberlain, playing on the TV, playing basketball on TV. And he says, "Mom, look at that." She comes over and says, "What?" And Jamien, his 7 years old, says, "His shoes." And his mom says, "So what?" He says, "I want to design shoes like that." He's 7 years old. He says to his mom, "Will you please go find me some multicolored clay so I can build a model?" Well, Jamien today is a very, very successful shoe designer and entrepreneur. And all of that came from a mom in poverty, single parent, paying attention to her child's interests and supporting them. She didn't want to go out and find clay. She didn't want to go out and find multicolored clay, but she did it anyway. Every parent can do that.
It boils down to being able to pay attention to your child in those rare small moments that happen when you least expect it. I mean, clearly in that story. We've got a couple minutes before we're going to have to say goodbye for at least this trip. What do you think that we need to be doing as a state, regardless of what happens with the innovation grants? I mean, money is tight. The governor may not get it for that. The ideas are great. The teachers were all hovered around tables talking to the governor at the conference a few weeks ago. So, I mean, clearly this is resonating with them. But in the absence of a grant that's going to bring this into the classroom for them, what are you telling teachers to do anyway?
Well, I think they're already doing it, Beth Ann. Communities all over the state, schools and PTOs are sponsoring showings of the film Most Likely to Succeed. And I think that's an important starting point because it shows how different education can be and must become for our kids to thrive and for our country to thrive. And that's where the conversation needs to start. And that's where so many of these innovations can happen on a very small scale. You don't need a new budget or a fund to have every child keep a question journal or begin to develop a portfolio using free software like Google Docs and having them present and defend their projects. You don't need money to do that. You need will. And that will, I think, comes from a different kind of mandate. When we begin to understand our kids need to be differently prepared, that's the beginning of a new mandate for both parents and teachers to work together to create these new models, starting small.
Tony, we have to go for the moment. The hour flew by. Thank you so much for the time. This time around, we'll look forward to your next visit.
My great pleasure, and it was fun talking to all of your community members out there. I wish I had more time to be here.
Well, next time, perhaps that we will. Thank you so much. Tony Wagner is expert in residence at Harvard's Innovation Lab and senior research fellow at the Learning Policy Institute. He's the co-author of Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Kids for the Innovation Era. And again, the film based on that will be shown in Hawaii next month. We'll put that up for you on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Take good care. Aloha.